Good morning. Today we're going to be talking with ISU Professor of English, Dr. Karen Coates. And not only is she a professor at Illinois State University, she is also the author of Bloomsbury Introduction to Children's and Young Adult Literature. Dr. Coates, thank you so much for joining me today.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Today we are talking about Tolkien Reading Day. It was started in 2003. This is the 15th year that it has been celebrated. As much as it's an institution, a cultural institution, it is not to be confused with Hobbit Day, which is actually in September during Tolkien Week. So there's a Tolkien Day, a Tolkien Week, and a Hobbit Day, and none of them are on the same day or week. But I think it's pretty cool. Tolkien Reading Day is chosen specifically for March 25th because it is in honor of the fall of Sauron, who's the main antagonist in the Lord of the Rings series.
Yeah, and I think it's important that we celebrate Tolkien all year round, so I'm glad that it's spread out throughout the year.
Sure. Yes, every winter I try and watch all six films just because I have a lot of time. There's snow on the ground and, you know, with snowstorms and blizzards and whatever, there's just more time to be able to focus on that as a way to honor him. And if I get a chance, read, but Tolkien is dense. And I think that's one of the main things that probably keeps people from reading him. They see that large tome and they're just like, I don't know if I can do this. But The Hobbit, by contrast, is a really concise, short read. It seems to really gravitate towards young kids and also just reading aloud to them. If you're looking for something that's sort of fantasy genre, but also doesn't get too bogged down in some things, it's a good read for, I would say, kids of any age, but also I'm a huge Tolkien nerd, so I don't know. I can't really assess what age I should start reading it to my son. He already is like seen everything and been read all the stuff, so I can't really tell. And he's three.
I remember reading it myself, and I was a good reader, but I remember reading it in sixth grade. So I was 10 or 11 because I was kind of a young sixth grader. And I remember distinctly thinking, wow, I'm really going to like this a lot better when I'm older. So I think it's one of those books that we want to introduce to kids very young. And I think that in many ways we're missing a lot of the early literature in favor of getting our kids involved a little bit too young in some of these things. But if you're reading it with your child or reading it to your child, that experience in and of itself is invaluable, simply because of Tolkien's attention to language. It's just his work is so rich that it's hard to know what kids are going to latch onto in terms of theme, but what they'll love is the sound. And so the sounds of his language, he was incredibly attentive in matching languages to the kind of characters that he created. So if you listen to the way he creates a language for the dwarves, a language for the elves, a language for the orcs, the Orokai, he tries to match the sonic pleasure of those languages with the character types that he's describing. So I think that kids get that on multiple levels. So I think, you know, start it as early as you want to.
And it definitely, yeah, I get what you're saying there. And it definitely seems like you can even divine some of the European languages and how they influence that. You know, the elves sort of have a very French sounding language, or at least in the way that they use their vowels, the way he explains it.
Exactly.
If you're a Tolkien nerd and you go into the appendixes of The Lord of the Rings, you see how he explains, like, well, the way you should accentuate language if you're speaking dwarvish is really more of like a Russian consonant. Like, all of those things, and he put so much of himself and so much of his linguistic abilities into really what we would call today world building. And in the larger scope of things, I would argue that this is one of the first universes, in the sense that A lot of times we see great fantasy novels and books, but they're sort of standalone books, and they can have some impact on society, but largely, you know, they're their own separate thing. But basically, once you adapt it so many times, and once it's been in a major motion picture, I think you ultimately get this idea that, like, there's this whole connected universe. And once you blow it up to that size, there's really no escaping Tolkien's fantasy. You know, where Narnia is a really interesting concept and construct, once you have several movies about it and a whole book series, Narnia is a real place, just like Middle Earth is a real place.
Well, and also, wow, there's lots of things. That opens up a whole lot of ways to think about this. One of them that I've been thinking about most recently is the fact that the appeal of having a secondary world has a lot to do with the fact that the world as we know it, our real world, has become so accessible via the internet, and it's just so big. It's just so big. And it's so indeterminate, I guess is what you say. And so a lot of kids go to fantasy, because, especially in their middle grade years, because they need a place that seems like it's under control. And so Tolkien has created these complete worlds that you can immerse yourself in, but you feel safer in those worlds than you do in the world in which you live, because it seems like no one's really controlling this world. So, you know, there's lots of... Tolkien said that because we're made in the image of a creator, we have this drive to be sub-creators. That is, we want to create our own little worlds. And part of that, I think, is this impulse to feel that we have some control over the world. We long for that. And so I think that when kids, especially when they start realizing just how big the world is and just how they're looking for a place that's theirs, that they can go to, that is a finished world, which is what the Tolkien universe is. It's a finished world. And then, not that there aren't places in that that they can inhabit and finish for themselves, but it seems safer, I guess, is
sure.
One thing.
Yeah, and it even, I mean, largely, obviously there are a ton of characters in Tolkien's works, major characters who do die, but for the most part, it seems like a place when even when you're in the worst possible place, so I would wager in The Hobbit, that would be being inside the Goblin King's lair and surrounded by goblins, you still feel like, even though it's a little bit, it makes you a little bit anxious and it makes you a little bit scared about, you know, what's going to happen, you still feel like everything's going to be okay.
You can actually exercise your fear. It's sort of exercise and exorcise, you know, that this idea that I can feel that emotion and then I can also come through that emotion on the other side knowing that I'm going to be okay.
We've talked a little bit about Tolkien's influence on the genre and a little bit about how he just navigates through this world, whether it's through the language or even the cultural standards of each race. You know, every so often it's intermixed. You know, hobbits do this and elves do this. But again, seamlessly through the narrative, which is really, it's almost as if he took the main narrative and then he wrote footnotes. And then when it was about to go to print, he was like, wait. Let's put the footnotes in the body of the text. That's what it seems like. When I read it now, I'm like, these are just footnotes. You could have this at the bottom. But if you're a kid, you're not going to read footnotes on the bottom of an epic story. You want it in the text. I mean, I don't know that you want it at all, but you're going to read it as long as it's part of the text of the story.
Sure. I mean, that's those kinds of authorial choices. Like you say, kids aren't going to read footnotes. They don't, and they shouldn't. If it's important enough to be in the text, it should be in the text. And if it's not, then it shouldn't be there at all. But yeah, so I have mixed feelings about that sometimes, because I'm like you. If it takes me out of the immediacy of the story, sometimes I feel a little resentful about that.
Sure.
But I'm a particular type of reader, and there are other kinds of kids who need to know all the stuff. They need to know all the things. And so I think that they would, one of the things that I've talked about with librarians in terms of finding read-alikes for The Hobbit, like, you love The Hobbit, what else would you like? And one of the things we had to talk about was that you can't just say, I love The Hobbit. You have to say, you have to probe that a little bit and say, well, why did you love it? What did you love about it? Because some people fall in love with the characters and the character types, and some people fall in love with the setting and the world. You know, who wouldn't want to live in the Shire? Well, that's my thing. I've got hobbity tendencies, and who wouldn't want to have 11 seasons, you know, all of those lovely things.
Oh, sure.
But then other people would want to live in Rivendell. So people have different ideas of what constitutes a good home, and Tolkien addresses that. There are lots of different good homes in those places, and there are some bad homes, or there's some, but then there's also, maybe you like the plot arc. Maybe you are one of these people who really keys to the hero's journey, you know, the underdog, or the reluctant, the person who's reluctant to leave home, but once he or she does leave home, they go through a series of adventures that eventually bring them back to the same place, but changed. So those kinds of things are, and then, of course, like we've already said, there are people who fall in love with the language, and that, and the poetry. My husband is a visual artist, and he's actually done a stunning series on The Lord of the Rings for MythCon, which is a conference that they have every year that celebrates the Inklings, which would be Tolkien and his and Lewis and Barfield.
Oh, sure.
The guys that he hung out with. But he's really keyed to he loves the poetry of it, but he also finds a lot of inspiration through imagining the world that Tolkien has created, imagining all of the different spaces. And so he finds his way in through the language and then translates that into visual images. So all of those things are different, would then lead you out of The Hobbit and lead you out of Tolkien's world into other worlds that pay attention to those particular kinds of things in different ways. So it's a kind of, your particular focus when you're reading is going to be different. Everyone's not, I mean, you know, they're clusters, but everyone has their way in to these texts. And of course, my father hated them. He doesn't do fantasy at all. So the Tolkien didn't touch my dad at all. So it's amazing to me how various people's responses can be.
And also, I think that can be attributed to, I think part of the thing that people forget or don't realize is that, you know, The Hobbit came out in 1937. And then The Lord of the Rings came out much later. But they're both sort of reflective of Tolkien's own experiences during World War I. Well, that's what some critics have been led to believe. If you take the prologue where Isildur takes the One Ring following, or no, I guess preceding The Hobbit, one could make the argument that just as that war, I guess during the Second Age, we're getting into the timeline here, which is a little confusing, but if you're taking it from that point, that reminds me a lot of the trench warfare that we sort of experienced as a nation during World War I. But the battle for Middle Earth, that, you know, the battles that we see throughout The Lord of the Rings and even a little bit in The Hobbit, I feel like that is much more reflective of World War II. I don't know, you know, it's never been confirmed because Tolkien specifically said it's not. I think some people of an older generation may not get into it specifically for that reason, because it reminds them of a time. It's nice because it reminds them of a time of like ultimate evil versus ultimate good, which is, I think, how most people categorize something like World War II, this world event that has a lot of moving parts, but at the end of the day, the one takeaway is that Nazis bad, people who fight Nazis good. I think that's something that like kids can glom onto too. Yeah, who are you gonna be rooting for? An old man with a long gray cloak who kind of talks funny and he's got these weird colloquialisms and he has a big staff and he likes to smoke his pipe, or a giant glowing fiery eye? Like, it's pretty obvious which one is the bad guy.
Well, and I mean, writers write out of their experience and then into the experiences around them. And Tolkien didn't see much combat because he was ill a lot of the time. He got trench fever and was taken out of combat. But by 1918, all but one of his best friends were dead. He needed to, I think there's some repair going on in this, by which I mean he needs to repair the world and to celebrate in some ways the heroism and the bravery and the camaraderie of men in combat, which I know, you know, that's a vexed thing these days. But like you say, then the stories we were telling about the morality of war and the morality of the wars that were happening, the specific wars that we had, were much clearer. And I think that in and of itself is, like you say, it's kind of it's a story that kids can relate to. We want to know who's on the side of right and who's on the side of wrong. We don't want a whole lot of moral ambiguity particularly at that age. We don't want to have to acknowledge that maybe our side wasn't completely right. So what happened, what Tolkien really did differently than other writers of his age was to celebrate that. Tolkien went in a completely different direction in his post-war literature, than the adult literature of the time. He went in a hopeful direction rather than in the nihilistic direction that characterizes so much of World War II literature for adults. This is what we call postmodern irony. There's nothing ironic about what Tolkien's doing. He's found a way to, in a very earnest way, to acknowledge the horrors of the war, acknowledge even the moral complexities of the time period without slipping into the fact that, yeah, people are terrible, the world is doomed, and there's nothing we can do about it. That Catholic vision of his, that we can repair the world, that it takes courage and sacrifice, that is his message. And it's also the message that Lewis picked up in some ways. So part of the reason why they have become so influential in fantasies that have come after is because they refuse this nihilistic vision that things are going to fall apart and there's nothing we can do. Instead, he says, you know, with bravery and with courage and with a willingness to put your life on the line for your friends and for the things you believe in, then yeah, you can make a difference. You can save the world. But he also, with Frodo in particular, acknowledged that you might save the world, but you don't save it for yourself. I love the fact that he has multiple visions of what happens after the end, after the big battle, after the end for Sam. Sam can go back and rebuild his life in the Shire and have all the homey pleasures that he's always wanted. But Frodo, on the other hand, has a version of what we might call PTSD. He can't stay in, or he can't go back to his armchair life, in a way, and smoke his pipe and say everything's fine. So I think that instead of making that, I mean, it's infinitely sad, but it's not without hope in the end. And so I think that is that he kind of needs for himself, after having lost so many friends, also the reason it's had such uptake in both children's fantasy and then fantasy as a genre, is that this is the place where we can do some repair and we can honor the bravery of people who believed in something bigger than themselves.
And I think that's a really important theme throughout. But also, I think the themes that sort of tie both The Hobbit and Lord of the Rings together are that, much like Frodo, Bilbo is also, he has the call to adventure, right? He has the quest. And I feel like the quest and power, and what power means and how power takes hold, those are two things that happen consistently through both narratives. And it's interesting, even still, that when Tolkien wrote The Hobbit, he didn't necessarily intend to continue that story. That was an isolated story, and he was like, okay, that's done. But when he started coming up with ideas for Lord of the Rings, the one ring that Bilbo had found sort of took on the most prominent role, I would say, in Lord of the Rings as an analog for the Ring of Gyges, which is, I think it's a Greek myth that once you put the ring on, you become invisible. And that, because he has such a professorial voice throughout both narratives, it makes sense that he would dig into more myth in order to create a connection between the narratives, and that everything has sort of a mythic real world analog to what he's talking about in the books. So I think that's pretty interesting. And as you said, very strongly, even though I don't think the hero's journey had come about yet, I mean, these are both clearly hero's journey prime examples, other one being Luke Skywalker, of course. But we see that they really do connect in a way that would be impossible, I think, to do without having Bilbo experience his journey first. And also that there's a lot of, I think there's a lot of focus on race as well as lineage in both books. And you kind of see that too in the idea of, you know, we have legacy characters throughout all of literature and comics and whatever, and it's pretty familiar with people. But I think this is also one of the first examples of that, where Bilbo is the man. I wish I had studied their lineage to know how he's connected. I think he's the great great grand uncle of Frodo.
You got me.
Okay.
But I haven't studied that lineage either.
Our acceptance.
Frodo is his heir. Frodo is his heir. That's all we know. We're not exactly sure.
Right.
And he didn't have children of his own, but Frodo is his heir.
From one hobbit to another. That should be a book. If you're looking for a book title, From One Hobbit to Another. If you're looking for, you know, that same kind of connection in, you know, ideally the same kind of character, they both exhibit a lot of the same characteristics. And I think you're right. I think it was a lot of self-repair on the part of Tolkien. And you can see that even in Bilbo, actually, in The Lord of the Rings, where he's exhausted. And, you know, part of that, I mean, as the book illuminates, part of that is the influence and power of the One Ring, which is just sapping him of his life force. But I think that is, again, it's all about analogs. It's all about creating, you know, there's a mythical or a magical explanation for something throughout the book. But in the real world, we would say, well, yeah, Frodo has PTSD. And in this case, I would say that Bilbo could be Tolkien's in-story character as a way of having survivor's guilt. Because, of course, Bilbo, throughout The Lord of the Rings, as per his experiences in The Hobbit, also discusses how he misses his time with the dwarves and his time with the elves. And he looks at things with a very nostalgic way. So I think those things are interesting, and it's palpable how similar both characters are and how they both take these larger looks at the world, like I said, through themes obviously of war, but also of power and influence and that call to adventure, the quest.
Sure. And then also, I think the other thing is that what constitutes a life well lived. And I think that, you know, part of one of the appeals for me anyway of both Bilbo and Frodo is this idea that, you know, we are comfort loving creatures. And perhaps, I mean, one of the reasons why Gandalf is so impressed with the sturdiness of the hobbits is that they're not people who seek power. They're not people who seek adventure, but they rise to the occasion. And I think that that's the character type that Tolkien admired most. In fact, in his, you know, in some of his letters and some of his nonfiction writing, you know, he talks about the fact that he doesn't necessarily, that it's a rare person who can be a leader of men. And the person who seeks that office is precisely the person you don't want in there. And so all of his leaders tend to be reluctant to take up that mantle, and yet they have to. And yet, because they can't let evil flourish. They can't let it go on. And so there's a call to, not a call to glory, but a call to duty, that I think he is exemplifying through both Bilbo and Frodo. It's not so much that they're going out because they want to, they're going out because they were called. And so that in and of itself is it's an ideology, right? That you're not going out because, gosh, I just want to go out and do something interesting. I want my life to be fascinating. No, my life is good and I'm comfortable. It's that old saying that we used to tell each other in the 80s is about, you know, a ship is safe in the harbor, but that's not what ships were built for. And the idea that we have to live in our times, and sometimes our times calls us to uncomfortable quests. And yet we have a responsibility to the gifts that we've been given, the world that we live in, our fellow man, to actually rise to that occasion, even if it means leaving the things that make us feel most comfortable with ourselves. So it's a very much, I guess, honoring characters who do their duty.
Sure. And I think it's also sort of an interesting thing that once you break down the characters of The Hobbit, certainly in Lord of the Rings, because there's such a variety of different races and different types of characters, one would not confuse Merry with Frodo or Sam with Pippin, let alone Legolas with Gimli or something. But everyone seems to be able to identify who they are in the story, which is interesting. And the Frodo and Bilbo, I think in today's YA and children's literature, it's a little disappointing because the main character is always sort of seen as like an empty glove. That's how I think of it, where you can just kind of step into it and you're the main character because they have such ill-defined traits of character. Like they're just analogous blob that you can just become. But I think that the main characters of both of these books really do have some substance to them. And as characters, they're very interesting, and they make choices that maybe you wouldn't make, but it's interesting how people are able to decide, like, yeah, I relate most to this character in the story. And all of these characters have interesting arcs and choices, and they're not afraid to do things that are a little bit unsettling, as you're saying. Have you studied this for classes? Do you dissect this work among your classes? And if so, you know, what types of reactions do you tend to get now versus maybe before, when it was still a very popular book franchise, but it wasn't necessarily something that was on film?
Well, I've actually never taught the book, I don't think. At least not since I was a grad student in the early 90s. And what I find is that my students are very, if they know this at all, they know it through the films, which even now, some of them have not even watched the films. It's, I have to kind of disagree with you a little bit on the blobby characters. What I see is more of a trend in contemporary children's fantasy in the legacy of, and in contradistinction to Tolkien's characters, is that all of the characters, or not all of them, but many of the characters in contemporary children's fantasy, the main characters, they have some sort of special skill. And this, to me, I think, is not, is completely different. I mean, Bilbo had no special skills, right? He became a burglar because Gandalf called him a burglar. He became who he was through his adventures rather than being called because he had some sort of special destiny. Those, that to me is in some ways doing some sort of damage to our idea of who we are, that we all have a special destiny. It's like, no, you don't have a special destiny. You're not, you become who you are through your adventures rather than being chosen because of some innate quality or some special talent, or you're divergent, or whatever it is that makes sure. you special. There's this, this idea that everyone has to be special in some way in order to have a great life, whereas Tolkien has a very different view that, that you should crave an ordinary life, but if you're called to adventure, you need to take it up. And then you'll develop the kinds of characteristics that you need as you go along, which I think is a much healthier way to think about the way a good life is lived. And so one of the things that we do talk about in my classes when we discuss fantasy is this idea of destiny and what constitutes, or how characters are delineated according to their destiny or their special talents. So I think that that's a completely different thing. It gives me new things to think about. I'm just trying to think about what kind of different ideologies that we're promoting now in the wake of the legacy that Tolkien has left us. I think there's been a shift, and I'm not sure that it's a good one.
Yeah.
I do think, I mean, just to give you an example, I sure. do think that Harry Potter would not have destroyed the Elder Wand if Tolkien had not had Frodo return the ring to Mordor. You know, like if we had stopped with the Hobbit and Bilbo had just been hiding the ring, but keeping it to himself, I think that's a different ending than the idea that the ring, that evil persists and you can't just sit on it, you can't just hide it, and essential goodness can't necessarily just keep it in a drawer somewhere or repress it.
Right.
We have to confront it. We have to take it. We have to take it on, and we have to destroy it. And that, this idea that, again, it's a cliche, but it's a cliche because there's some truth in it, that power corrupts and absolute power corrupts absolutely. That's the kind of message that is carried forward in, say, for instance, the Harry Potter saga, that if you have too much power, it's power itself that becomes your drug, or that becomes your, that causes you not to live ethically. And so it's power itself that must be set aside if we want to live a good life.
And I think we see the effects of that even in Lord of the Rings. Obviously, the most poignant examples, I would say, are people like Saruman and Gollum. And to an extent, there are some interesting parallels, actually, with Voldemort in the first and second books before he mm-hmm. has a real corporeal body that he can pursue evil deeds with. You know, Sauron, for much of the series, is a glowing red eye. So knowing that, like, you know, those two really, they have so much influence, but they don't have a body to pursue their malignant plans. That is something that I think it's worth noting, how much power they still have because they can exert it over people like Gollum and Saruman. And even in more heroic characters like Boromir, who, you know, not a bad person, but, you know, this idea that power corrupts, that's immediately apparent in especially Sean Bean's performance of Boromir, which if anyone is ever a fan of Sean Bean or you see Sean Bean in something, I automatically go, oh, that person's going to die. Whoever whoever that character is, that person's going to die. They hired Sean Bean. That person's going to die. He's a very...
He's great at dying.
He's so good at dying every time. It's always unique and interesting. No, I just... I laugh. It's the worst response, but I do laugh during that fight scene towards the end of The Fellowship of the Ring, which does contradict, actually, the Two Towers, where Boromir actually dies at the beginning of that book. But he gets shot, you know, two or three times, and each time keeps coming back up and like, yeah, no, I'm going to keep doing it. Like, no, man, you're done. You're done. Lay down.
That is a trope. You know, so many times I'm like these people who get mortally wounded and then just keep on going. I'm like, no, you just say, okay, I'm done now.
Right.
I've been mortally wounded. Can I go home?
Time out.
But, yeah, exactly. Exactly. This really hurt. And I just don't feel like doing this anymore. But yeah, that scene where Boromir is talking to Aragorn is, I mean, I think that was right, even though it violates the book. I think it was right for the film because we needed to preserve his heroism and to have him repent, to let him know that repentance, or to let the viewer know that his repentance is real and whole, and that, okay, so he gives us a lot to think about here, in the sense that I'm sitting here as a viewer, I'm sitting here as an 11-year-old. It's like, well, if I had the ring, I would do the right thing. I would do the right thing. Or, and same with Gandalf. Gandalf has that struggle where I would want to use the ring for good, or even contemporary. If I were Harry Potter and I had all three of the Deathly Hallows, I would not be corrupted by them. And that's just not true. Once you have that power, it's going to have its own intentions, which sounds a little airy-fairy, like, ooh.
Sure.
But I think it's true that evil has intentions of its own. And that is not, I mean, that's a Christian worldview, certainly, in some ways animistic, to think that an object would have power of its own. But if you think of it as an object that is ruled by a power outside itself, then sure, it's going to have power over human behavior that it is not intended. And even Tolkien's making a really pointed point that even if that power is dispersed among lots of different people, like the elves have their rings and the humans have their rings, there's still that kind of sovereignty. It belongs to an evil entity outside ourselves. So that one ring to rule them all, it's not enough to have, what do you call it, a separation of powers, or, you know, after World War II, where the Russian spy, the Manhattan Project, who gave the codes for the nuclear, or the way to build a nuclear bomb to Russia, because he believed that it would not be good for America to be the only country, the only nation, the only power to have a nuclear capability. He felt like the only way to preserve was balance. You needed balance. And so that's why he betrayed his country, but he did it because he believed that it was not a good thing for only one superpower to have that capability. So Tolkien is even going up against that. The idea that, which obviously I don't think he would have known, because nobody really knew. But the idea that even if that kind of power is dispersed, it's still not good. It still needs to be broken.
And it's interesting that the throughout the books and also the movies, even though the One Ring is the thing that we focus on, there are several rings of power that are dispersed to each. They have rings of power to each of the 9 mortal men doomed to die, which become the ring wraiths, who instinctively search out the ring. We have 5 rings for the dwarf lords and 3 for the elves, and one of those elves ends up being Galadriel. So if Rivendell is the heads up side of a quarter, the tails is certainly Mirkwood, which is
right.
I guess it's East Coast, West Coast elves, really. That's what it's, that's the best way to explain it. And we see these West Coast elves, even then, Galadriel still has her own individual ring of power, but also in the film, we see that she, you know, Frodo freely admits it to her, and she almost takes it and turns into this most terrifying thing. I don't think there was a more terrifying thing for me as an 11-year-old or a 12-year-old than that scene of her being like, "And you will have a dark and beautiful queen." Like, I also very conflicted because I was like, it's Cate Blanchett, and I think she's real cute, but wow, I never want to see that again, ever.
Well, it tapped into a primal fear of this all-devouring mother.
Yeah,
What would happen if your mom were bad?
I can't handle that. I don't know what that says about me psychologically, what my profile is, but I can't handle a evil mom. But I feel like, you know, a lot of the times when we see somebody perish or fall in battle, and specifically Boromir, when he's saying, "Hey, did they make it out okay? Are they all right?" That is very reflective of Tolkien's own Catholic faith, which permeates a lot of the books. I would say much in the same way that C.S. Lewis, you know, his Christian faith definitely permeates large swaths of the Chronicles of Narnia.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, they are the Chronicles of Narnia are more closely allegorical to the biblical stories, and in particular the New Testament stories. But what Tolkien does is, by bringing together all of these mythologies, is under this sort of Catholic rubric, is to create a meta-narrative that has influenced fantasy going forward. So it's one of those things that reaches back in time. He's pulling in a lot of Nordic mythology. You mentioned the Greek mythology, but he's pulling from the poetic and prose Edda, which were the Icelandic sagas, and then the Nordic sagas of the Volsung Nibelungalai. I'm not pronouncing that right, but I think it's close.
That's the Ring series, right?
Yes. And so all of those, what I like about this particular, about that move to take ancient myth and ancient stories, bring them forward and rework them in contemporary context, I think it draws the through line that, from a distinctly Christian perspective, says all truth is God's truth, and we are made in the image of God. And I think that is fully in line with what Tolkien, and both Tolkien and Lewis, were doing to help people understand that the stories that we have are part of all cultures, insofar as, when I teach my storytelling class, I said, you know, there's lots of different ways you can think about this. You can think about this from a purely secular standpoint and say that stories traveled with commerce, worldwide commerce. Stories from the Eastern world traveled along the Silk Road. Stories from the North traveled down through through storytellers and bards that came traveling, whatever. So you can look at this from a perfectly secular standpoint. But on the other hand, you can also look at this from a Christian standpoint, where if we are in fact made by a God who wants us to know him, then the stories that we tell are pointers to the kind of God he is. So we have stories of redemption. We have stories and how he would envision the world, how we would envision ourselves as being both made in the image of God, but also fallen. So you have Boromir coming along and doing this thing where he has been tempted. He has in some ways succumbed to that temptation, and yet he has repented. And his final act is that act of redemption, that greater love hath no man than he lay down his life for his friends. And those are the kinds of things, those are the kinds of themes that resonate through all of these myths. And so they can't be accidental. They have to say something about who we are as human beings with the same creator. And I think that that's kind of what you're getting through Tolkien. And then that becomes an influential meta-narrative that even somebody like Neil Gaiman says he's an atheist. Okay, you're an atheist. Who are your influences? Tolkien and Lewis. Oh, well, you're still telling a Christian meta-narrative in your stories. You're still telling a story of fall and redemption. And most of your stories have to do with fall and redemption, nobility, the nobility of a human being, and the great evil that a human being is capable of. And the fact that in the end, if you repent, then things turn around. But if you don't, then you are destroyed. And so those kinds of themes permeate all of fiction post Tolkien and Lewis, because they drew from fiction that came before them. And I say fiction mythologies, religious traditions, all of those things, they pulled all that together into a tapestry that we have been pulling out threads and remaking ever since.
Sure. And I give young adults a little more credit just because they're still forming who they are, and they're really, I don't think I've ever been more adventurous about trying out different things than when I was in middle school, specifically because I had no idea who I was, and I was trying to find out like what things work, what things don't, you know? But do you think that some of this, you know, the reason why it's so successful is that, or that these books are so successful, is that, you know, other narratives, when you are a teenager and you're reading, say, something like J.D. Salinger's Catcher in the Rye, which, of course, is a classic, do you find that, you know, as people get older, I've read Catcher in the Rye at least 4 or 5 times since I read it originally, and it doesn't move me in the same way it once did. And I think that's a common thing, is that once you grow up, there's a line in Breakfast Club, once you grow up, your soul dies, or something like that. You just grow up. You become an adult. It's inevitable.
Sure.
Mm-hmm. Do you feel like the reason this still permeates, though, that these books manage to sort of circumvent that post-adult death is because Tolkien not only talks in a very authoritative professorial voice, but also as a result of that, he's treating the children who would read this book as adults, as framers of their own minds?
I think, okay, again, this is one of those complex questions. One of the things that we have to understand, and this is something that more recent look at the actual working living brain has taught us, is that, you know, as children, we feel more soulful because we're operating from our feelings. The limbic system and the amygdala are far more developed in early childhood through middle school than our prefrontal cortex, which is the CEO of the brain, basically.
Our judgment.
And it is the one that does our reality checks.
Sure.
And it also does this thing called an inhibitory function, which means that you don't have to act on everything you feel. You can see that some people develop that more than others. But what that means for children in particular is that they can actually enter into fantasy worlds a lot better than adults can. They have the ability to really inhabit a fantasy in ways that we always kind of, as adults, step back and have a remove from that, okay? So Tolkien's structure has placed us already in that remove because it's not the real world, okay? And we're going to inhabit it differently when we're children because we can inhabit it more fully than we do as adults. But if we do experience it as children, it becomes part of our imaginary geography. It becomes part of our memory structure so that when we go forward in the world, we are drawing on that memory structure as we encounter new narratives and as we encounter even our sense of ourselves or as we develop our sense of ourselves. So all of that is happening. The other thing that's happening in those middle grade years is that you are, as you are developing, as your brain is developing, you are starting to develop a sense of what your true self is and what your false self is. So you're experimenting with different, your self is fragmenting. And you say things like, well, you know, I feel sad when I'm with my parents. I'm sad and quiet, but with my friends, I'm really talkative. And I can't reconcile that because I don't have the capacity to form these higher level abstractions, which would say, oh, I'm moody. Right. Before it's just like, no, I'm happy and I'm always going to be happy. And then the next day I'm sad and I'm always going to be sad. So it's a difficult time because you're breaking apart and you don't yet have the higher order coordination skills to bring it all back together. Okay. So that's another reason why the different characters become salient for you because you're feeling like you've become different characters inside your own head. Right. So that's also, all that's happening. It's kind of a big, challenging mess. But then, so what books like The Lord of the Rings offer are these metaphors, or what you were saying, analogs to that experience, which is why they're so compelling at that age. But then they get braided into the people that we become, so that as adults, they're still really important components of our sense of self. And they're still actually kind of, what we call it, like markers that we can refer to when we're feeling out of sorts or when we're feeling disingenuous or false to ourselves. Wait, who am I really? We go back to these structures and ideas. I remember, just to give you kind of a concrete example, I remember when I watched, you know, I'd read The Hobbit, like I said, when sixth grade, and I read The Lord of the Rings all through high school and again in college. And then, you know, you go away from that for a while and you start reading other things. And like you say, you read Catcher in the Rye and Everybody's a Phony. And you read different things where the different kinds of tragedies and different kinds of realistic portrayals of life. And they seem so local. They don't seem mythic anymore. So the attraction to myth keeps drawing us back because we want our life to have significance. We want our life to have significance beyond this very local moving through this very banal life that we live. And so being able to place the events of our lives into a mythic framework remains appealing because it's something that created us in the first place. Right? In those junior high and middle school years. Getting back to my concrete example. My concrete example was when I saw the first Lord of the Rings film, I had what I call a personal epiphany. I said, you know, for the last maybe 20 years, I've thought of myself as a human aspiring to be an elf, right? Aspiring to be ethereal and connected to nature and all that kind of stuff. When really I'm a hobbit. I like home. I like comfort, you know? And so I was like, yeah, I had an epiphany. This is who I am. And other people I know are going to be, humans. Other people I know are going to be more elvish. Other people I know are going to be dwarves or orcs or trolls, but I'm a hobbit. So that kind of connection was actually a reconnection to the values that I grew up with. I come from a rural area. I grew up on a farm, close family, good food, comfort, and left that for a while to become ambitious and educated and all those sorts of things, and then realizing that, whoa, wait, sometimes we need reminders of who we are that take us back to those middle school years of when we were becoming who we are.
And you know what? I think that's a brave choice. I would say that both my wife and son are also hobbits. And it's I think it's brave to pick hobbit. If you're going to align yourself with a specific race, I think it's a brave thing to pick a hobbit. Because a hobbit, as you eloquently stated, sort of has, I mean, good food, home is where the heart is kind of attitude. And, you know, they're very neat and they live in these nice little homes that are so interesting. But life is very banal by comparison to some of the other things that are happening in Middle Earth. And, you know, I would like to say that I'm Captain of the Guard in Gondor or something like that, or I'm, you know, one of the horsemen in the Rohirrim in the western state of Rohan, but I'm probably just the watchman at that bar that's like not 45 miles away from Hobbiton, where I'm like, who goes there? And then the horses that are being ridden by the ringwraiths just trample me. You know, that's probably who I am. It's probably, or I'm just like that random guy that you see in like one scene in Helm's Deep and you're like, oh, he's an interesting character. I wonder if nope, he's dead. Okay.
He's gonna die. Yep.
So I'm the Sean Bean of the situation, probably.
There you go.
But
well,
I don't,
that's heroic.
I don't get the redemption. Because I didn't have that big an arc. It's just, okay, you stand here, you have a sword, and then that guy's going to come at you. Okay, so then I beat him? No, you die. Okay. That's fine.
Okay, yeah, okay. So I like I said, I think that one of the things that I really appreciate even in like a contemporary book like Holes by Louis Sachar, which came out
totally.
In the late 90s.
Totally. Love Holes.
You can still trace the hero's journey in that book. You can still trace the guy who has to leave home, doesn't want to. Ordinary guy has to leave home, doesn't want to, and has to rise to an occasion of heroism because he's actually hurt someone. And because his family has hurt people. And then bigger, because his race has hurt people. And so his job, he personally didn't do anything wrong, and yet he is responsible for doing the bit of repair in the world that needs doing. And so that's kind of the arc of that story. And in a sense, it's the arc of all our stories. We're not responsible for the past, but we didn't do the harm in the past, but we are responsible for doing what we can to repair the effects of that. And again, this is something that resonates, especially for, well, that needs to resonate, I say, especially for kids, because that those middle grade years, you're not just looking for who you are, you're looking for, am I significant? What can I do in the world that makes a difference? And that is something that, you know, it unfortunately attracts a lot of kids to video games, and they get that dopamine rush that says they're significant, but it's not real. They're not really doing anything in the world to make it real. So the problem with that, obviously, is that, you know, the narrative of the video game isn't big enough. And I think that that's another reason why we need lots of Tolkien days, because he has written narratives that are big enough for us to imagine ourselves into and understand that we are part of a larger story and that we have a role to play, that if we don't play that role, if you aren't the Sean Bean character or if you aren't the guy who stands there and gets killed, then you lose your opportunity for significance.
Just to add to that, I have played 4 different types of Lord of the Rings games, and none of them are quite as good as my own imagination, just thinking about how certain events play out. Nothing, no movie, I mean, maybe some of the Lord of the Rings movies and some of the Marvel movies and things like that, maybe some of those come close, but even still, nothing is as vivid or as imaginative as my own imagination. And even if I'm reading something on the page, the world building that Tolkien does, although it's especially specific and it makes note of lots of unremarkable things, nothing is as world encompassing and as remarkable as my own imagination.
Well, and I think that, you know, part of the reason why he was able to create such a complete world is because of his own immersion into this multifaceted mythic structure, right? He drew not only from these ancient myths that I talked about, but also from contemporary stories that he was doing and the world he lived in, and also the nature that he walked around in. He walked around the Malvern Hills. If you've ever walked around the Malvern Hills, then you know what the Shire looks like. I mean, he's had this rich heritage of both beauty and pain to draw from. It was both real and what we would call virtual. That is, not virtual like from the screen, because I think you're right. Screens kind of take away our sovereignty over the image. You know, they replace your vision with someone else's vision. Okay? And that kind of locks you in. Whereas if you're able to create your own imagery, and again, you know, that's another one of those places where the human brain is variable. For some people, their visual imagination isn't as strong. And so their imagination of what's happening on the page isn't as active as maybe yours was, or like I said, my husband's, who is a visual artist. I'm not a very good spatial reader, like I'm not spatial in terms of if someone's describing very carefully how someone's negotiating a path, I just take it for granted that, yeah, they know what they're doing because I can't visualize that. But that doesn't inhibit my enjoyment of that text, and it doesn't inhibit my ability to, in some ways, make it my own in ways that a film or a video game that's leading me through someone else's vision of it does. So we want to maintain, I mean, the superiority of the, I like to think of the visual text and the print text as two different media. They foreground different things. And so I don't try to compare them against each other, but instead to say, what are my takeaways from this print text? What are my takeaways from this visual text? And then in the video game, what am I taking away from this immersive text? And I do, I'm like you, I think that the video games are an inferior media, mostly because they don't have that rich immersion in the mythic stories. I mean, I think that a lot of the people who make the video games are more focused on the here and now and the technical aspect of it than they are on the narrative complexity, obviously. They've got to simplify.
Sure, yeah. And at a certain point, the mission is getting from point A to point B, and you got to carve through the orcs to get to it. Like, okay. I mean, that's fun, and man, it gets your aggression out for sure if you had a rough day at school being called a nerd or something. But
sure.
Or, you know, whatever. I mean, that's a little bit of my own personal life blending into that narrative.
Yeah, it is. I mean, you're personal, but you're also part of a, it's not unique to you, I guess is what I'm saying. It's a lot, what they're finding, especially for young men, you know, that they're having a hard time acclimating to their jobs because, you know, you work at a Wendy's and you're not in charge and your boss is a jerk and you're not feeling any sort of power or meaning. It's much more gratifying to go home and kill some orcs. where you do feel like you're having some power. But again, ultimately, it's only satisfying in the moment and doesn't deepen your understanding of who you are.
Yeah, it's fleeting. You know, I realized that we focused a lot about the ring, which is important, obviously. Again, I would say it's the most important character of the entire series. But, you know, I know that we talked a little bit about survivor's guilt and people dying, mm-hmm. of course, Sean Bean. But there's also this sense of death, sort of a, again, coin flip of death and immortality on each side of that coin, and other mystic items like the, oh man, I'm sure I'm going to mess this up, the Sword of Elendil, which you recall from the movies, again, I don't necessarily remember all of the things about it, all of the little intricate details of it in the book, but the Sword of Elendil is Isildur, Aragorn, Viggo Mortensen's heir, his sword, which shatters upon slicing off the one finger of Sauron that has the ring on it. So when, and the reforging of that sword allows Viggo Mortensen's character Aragorn to assemble the army of the dead, which is an especially cool sequence of events. I like
visual
that a
effect.
Lot. Yeah. I mean, plot holes being what they are, obviously in the books, you know, J.R.R. Tolkien has, I always assume that authors have a much more controlled idea of where the narrative is going, and that on the page, it makes a lot more sense. But I feel like movie producers and the like tend to say, yeah, and then we have this happen, and man, it blows up the screen. We're going to have special effects wall to wall. And then you have what today we perceive as trolls, which, you know, in Tolkien's universe are big, gross things. And in our universe are big, gross things who are on the internet talking about people in a negative light. And you hear comments like, well, why don't they just have the undead army kill the rest of them for the rest of the movie? So you do have those weird plot holes, I think, throughout the movies that are, they make sense, but they're also one of those things where I was like, well, I'm not sure that that's the focus, though. I think that's a power trip. You know, I think if you're in a game and you're like, oh, I can do that, cool, that's what I'm going to do. That's one thing. But I think narratively, you know, authors are going to exercise control over something that they know is so powerful they could use it all the way through. Much like the sword isn't used that often. And also it's done in a way that it's sort of like a lightsaber. A few lightsabers at critical points in the narrative is an interesting way to establish a conflict. Tons of lightsabers all at once with a bunch of CGI effects is not very compelling, because eventually it's sensory overload and you're like, well, it doesn't make a difference now because everyone has one.
Right.
But I think those other magic objects bring another sort of world building to the narrative, that, you know, there's this combination of nature and technology and magic, and it's all kind of happening at once. And then we also see these, again, I assume the influence is from his own religious beliefs, but we also see this permanence in the ideas of death and what death means and how people can become immortal, or even people who are seemingly immortal are not. People like Gandalf, who, if you've never read The Fellowship or you never watched The Fellowship, you might think that Gandalf died in that first book or movie against the Balrog. And then
Right. Mm-hmm.
And then he makes a Obi-Wan Kenobi type turn. Again, I use Star Wars just as a way to access like all the different things in Lord of the Rings, but really Lord of the Rings came first, and George Lucas kind of ripped off a lot of stuff from Tolkien. Not the other way around.
Well, let's say, you know, Christ came first because the resurrection. Or we could even, I mean, you know, if you want to even go further and say, you know, Osiris came first or the Fisher King. All of these gods that die, that must die and then get reborn into a different status or a different, is, again, it's one of those framing narratives that you find in a lot of different mythologies. And like Lewis said, you know, there's one mythology he believes is true that doesn't negate the power of the rest of them. And he talked about the fact that, you know, the mythology that he believed is true isn't the one he liked the best, which is why he included a lot of dwarves and other creatures in his mythology, because Christianity was, in fact, too real. So it didn't satisfy his imagination fully, even though he believed that it was true. So,
right.
But go ahead. The idea of this resurrection, these characters, as you say, with death, that death isn't necessarily permanent, that death is, in fact, a passage. I mean, I think that that's one of the, you know, you can think about Frodo's going to the land of the West or going to the West as being a passage, but it's also a death in some ways.
Yeah.
So there are lots of different configurations of that. Again, he's drawing, like Tolkien, as you draw from different mythologies, you also get different, what we call different ontologies. I think it was Umberto Eco who said that the only thing a world vision can't accommodate is another world vision, which, in other words, what we have a hard time imagining, what everyone has a hard time imagining, is an alternative ontology, an alternative way of being in the world. And so Tolkien offers us a world where things have power, where places are sacred, and where people are moved by, or animals are, and trees are animate and responsive to human beings. And that, in our scientific secular world, we don't believe that. You know, we don't believe that things all by themselves are powerful or that things have intentions. We don't believe that there are places, we don't believe in ley lines, for instance, or places that are necessarily sacred because of where they are. But other ontological traditions do. I mean, there's a reason why Jerusalem is such a vexed site and the Temple Mount is such a vexed site, because, you know, people believe that that place has significance. And there are people who still believe in ley lines. You know, we dismiss it as something called animism. That is, that there would be a spirit in a rock or a spirit in a ring. But there are people who still believe that. I think what happens in Tolkien is that he honors those beliefs and in some ways refreshes them for a lot of people, but also suggests to us in a way that is evocative that we don't know everything, that our scientific world doesn't have all the answers. Hold that out, that science is going to give us all the answers, that our knowledge is not simply incomplete, but fantasy can play with the world and say that, no, it might not just be incomplete, it might be incommensurable. There might be real paradoxes. There might be things that we just haven't imagined yet, or things that exist that we don't have names for. And that's important, not just for the secular imagination, but it's also important for the scientific imagination, because it induces humility and continues a quest.
Yeah, I completely agree. And again, it's so interesting to see how he couples all of the different types of myths and all of the different types of cultures and how they, you know, how stories develop over a cultural import. You know, certainly the German influence and the unpronounceable name, the Nibelung, the Ring series.
The Nibelungenlied.
Yeah, that. I just let you say it and then go, yeah, that. Those things carry a certain level of their own culture to them. And if there's animism in those myths, then it's probably a reflection of the time in which the story was created, and there wasn't so much, I think, so much writing on the idea of, like, well, spirits can be in things because, hey, you know, not too long ago, people thought the Earth was flat. And great news, people still think the Earth is flat. Some people do. So things like that never necessarily go away.
And we also can't feel superior. The minute you say, my computer hates me.
Right.
or my car always breaks down when I need it the most. Or the reason it's raining is because it's raining because I have a picnic scheduled. You're participating in that animistic fantasy. We don't give it up. I mean, it is part of childhood, but it's part of every human childhood, but it's also translates into adulthood, even though you can, then our prefrontal cortex kicks in and says, yeah, that's not true. But it doesn't matter. We've already made that decision.
Yeah.
But inanimate objects. Yeah, that thing is watching me.
Well, and in the case of another technological world, if you're saying something like, I don't know, Black Mirror, that might be true. But the good news is,
but if you've ever gone into the woods and felt either supported or watched,
yeah,
I mean, this is part of our human experience, and I think that, you know, even though we can very calmly and rationally say, yeah, no, it persists. And so why does it persist? Does it persist because we're just naive, or does it persist because there's something out there that's real that we just don't acknowledge, we don't see?
Things to think about, for sure. Thank you very much for coming on the show, Dr. Coates. I appreciate it. And once again, my guest has been Illinois State University Professor of English, Dr. Karen Coates. Again, she is the author of Bloomsbury, Introduction to Children's and Youth Adult Literature. Dr. Coates, is there anything else that you may be working on now that you'd like to promote, or anything else coming up in the future?
I just would give us a plug for anyone who's really interested in fantasy. There is a chapter devoted to fantasy in that Bloomsbury Introduction to Children's and Young Adult Literature that doesn't necessarily refer to Tolkien specifically, but really talks about the big questions that fantasy asks and how they're so important for young people. So that's all I would say. But yeah, I want to thank you for this conversation. It was fascinating and gave me lots of new things to think about.
Thank you.